Cool.
When I was in art history, when I was in school studying art history, we were taught around 3, but no, it's 5. So we're long backs just considered sexy at the time? No. This is so that we can look at her breast and her butt at the same time. Her hips are also turned in a certain way. This pose is impossible to do with a human body, and it'd still be alive afterwards. So in fandom, we call this a B&B pose, or boobs and butt pose. And this is a boobs and butt pose from 200 years ago. This is a newer one. Again, that spine doesn't bend that way. Not without serious injury to the body. And this is repeated a lot. There's an X23. That's a 90 degree angle, folks. 90 degrees. This image of Rogue here, I really love to talk about and make fun of. It doesn't look too bad at first, but you can see the front of her breast and the back of her butt. And the artist knows that the body doesn't work that way, because when he got to the middle, he was like, oh crap, what do I do? So he put a cape, which, you know, does its job, but if that cape wasn't there, you would see... Hello? Hello? I'm going to try to make this work. Can I get a little bit more?
That's all you got.
Yeah, stuff tapes down.
All right. Let me try to make this work. So, if that cape wasn't there, we would be looking at belly button and also spine. And that obviously doesn't make any sense. This is Wonder Woman. Again, 90 degree angle. The thing that is so amazing about this is her spine would be broken. But what's funny is when Batman actually had his spine broken, not as much of an angle. So the one on the the one on the right, that's a break in spine, and the one on the left, that's just business as normal. The pose, this like boob and butt pose. It gets to be, that's the same pose. It's like the British drawing, like stock images. Like, oh, this one it's her with a sword fighting, and this one it's her dodging an arrow. It's the same thing. Last one we're going to talk about is situational pretense. This is a bathing painting, which again, it's an excuse essentially to paint naked women, and that's what I mean by situational pretense. It's creating a situation that justifies what you've done in your work. So here, the artist wanted to paint naked women interacting with each other, splashing each other. Oh no, sticking out my butt at the bottom. So they were like, oh, well, you know, it's not perverted, it's not dirty. It's the opposite, they're getting clean. It's not being perverted. And comic books do this too. This one's a little different than the other ones. This is more of a justification for some of the things that we talked about earlier. And comic books have stolen this. These are from Sheena, in the 40s. And the first one even says, in the heat of the day as Sheena bathes, and she's just bathing. The one on the right, she just got out of the water and she's dripping wet, and thankfully there are leaves there because, you know, the comic code authority and all that. And this has been modified. Sometimes they're swimming and not bathing.
Hello?
Awesome. All right, so sometimes they're swimming and not bathing. These are two images from, it was the 90s, you guys. both by Jim Lee. And the one on the left, she's swimming, and at least it kind of adds to the story slightly, I guess. I don't know. Depends on your definition. The one on the right, I'll read you just a little bit of it there. To put this in context, an alarm goes off, so at the X-Mansion, they're all scrambling. And Cyclops is going, Scott, what is happening? The alarms. And Psylocke is like, yes, I was doing laps in the pool. Oh, okay, well, good. That's, you know, that was an excuse to put her in a bathing suit, which is funny because if you're familiar with her costume, it's basically a bathing suit anyway. This whole swimming thing has a... Okay, so you... Okay. don't have to say a lot about this one then. This was a couple panels from just multiple pages. The middle image was actually, this is from Red Hood and the Outlaws number one, New 52. The middle image was actually part of an image, it's a detail of an image they were actually using to promote the book. So this is what they decided, they're like, hey, we want to sell a book about Red Hood and the Outlaws, so here's a woman in a bikini. Also, this isn't the Red Hood, I just want to clarify that. And now it's not always bathing. Sometimes, you know, it's... sometimes it's, you know, bondage. Oh, you know, Wonder Woman's in trouble. The squid's pulling her. That's why her spine's at a 90-degree angle. The one on the left, it's, you know, she's trapped in, like, this force-filled pyramid. And what's ridiculous is I know that they make force-filled pyramids tall enough for her to stand because all the men are standing in the back in the same pyramid. But this one, they were like, we need to give her a little short, stumpy one. So she has to kind of do this and, you know, thrust her breast and genitals forward towards the reader. Not a whole lot's changed. So, again, let me put this in context. Lex Luthor has captured most of the Justice League. So down there in the bottom, we have the android Red Tornado being disassembled. Up in the background, you can kind of see in the top right, Batman's chained up, and some of the other Justice Leaguers are chained up. And Lex has built this special machine that makes Wonder Woman be spread eagle right there in the middle. We have two B&B poses. And poor Vixen has this like this metal aperture digging into her back for no reason, not for no reason, but it's to force her into a 90-degree angle, which we know would break her spine. But it's mostly just to make that S-curve. So there's no reason for this. Doesn't advance the story. And this shows the difference in kind of the treatment, typically, of men and women. But it can get more disturbing, because sometimes they throw in a little bit of torture. This is from the infamous Stephanie Brown power drill torture scene. And they decided that they needed to put in, I guess, a little TNA. So, you know, she's chained up, and after being tortured, she's tired, so she's limping forward like that. And if that's too subtle for you, here is Zatanna about to be drilled from behind by the Joker and Dr. Light, who is a known rapist. Yeah. Jumping is also an excellent excuse to show both sides of a woman, I guess. Fighting. I don't know a whole lot about hand-to-hand combat, but I don't think that involves thrusting your genitals at one another. And I don't really think that the men fight that way. But the women do a lot. Another thing, jump kicks. Very popular jump kicks. Again, I don't know a lot about hand-to-hand combat, but I thought you're supposed to protect this whole middle area. But no. I'm just gonna go. Okay. And again, kind of like the Venus of Urbino. If you don't know what you're supposed to look at, they drew like a laser beam going towards it. Now keep in mind these four different methods of objectification. This isn't a comprehensive list. You know, this isn't a how-to spot objectification. There are other ways to objectify a human form. This is just some of the most prevalent. But thankfully, just as some of the artists of the past have pioneered ways to objectify women art, some artists have fought against these tropes. And one of my favorites is Monet. So this at first looks kind of like all the other ones that we've seen. It's a naked woman laid out on a bed. But there are some subtle and important differences. They're subtle by today's standards, but if you were alive 150 years ago and knew anything about art, it would be very, very apparent. And in fact, people got very, very angry when this image came out. But throw it up next to the Venus of Urbino, and Titian actually drew studies from the Venus of Urbino, so we know that he saw it. I'm going to let art historian Eunice Lipton explain this one. The conventions associated with that figure of the reclining nude, whether the image was of Venus, which we talked about, or some anonymous odalis always emphasized female sensuality and tactically implied its availability. Monet's Olympia does neither. She is not voluptuous in a traditional sense, nor is she served up to the viewer. Quite the contrary, she is aloof, self-contained, and almost disdainful. She dares her visitor and stares him down. Her facial expression is a lot like that Namor that we saw earlier. She's in control of her space. And in fact, she has a servant bringing her flowers that she does not care about. So the implication there is that, oh, some men send her flowers and she's not impressed. There are also a couple other subtle differences. On the left, the Venus of Urbino, that dog, that's a sign of fidelity. So this is very, like, this is a marital thing. There's also kind of that chest in the background, it's kind of like a hope chest. This whole thing's very domestic. The one on the right, Manet's replaced the dog with a cat, which is the exact opposite. Also, Olympia is, that means prostitute. So he's played with conventions a lot. That really made people angry. The biggest difference is there's that masturbation that we talked about earlier on the left. Now, the figure's not worked up a lot on the Olympia on the right, but Manet really outlined that hand to show that he's actually blocking. She's blocking, and it's a very disdainful, very protective kind of a. I don't say protective. It's defiant. She's challenging the male viewer, and so the same type of parody and reappropriation happens a lot in fan art. So this was a little bit of. I think some people know what's coming here in a second. This was promotional art for the Avengers, and again, we have that B&B pose on the Black Widow, because apparently super spies only, like, look over their shoulder when fighting. So we have that. I'd like to point out that it's called Avengers Booty Assemble. So this is the Wonder Woman butt, courtesy of Frank Miller, that we talked about earlier. Remember how I asked you, imagine bulging briefs and...
I did.
You don't have to imagine. Because the internet has done it for you. So this is what it would be like if men were treated like women in mainstream comics. Those 90-degree angles that we talked about. The one on the left is She-Hulk. And the one on the right is a 3D model that somebody made based off of the picture. And as you can see, that the body doesn't work that way, folks. Like, it didn't even really look natural from one angle, much less all the others. Then finally, we want to talk about the Hawkeye Initiative. Yeah! So, if you're unfamiliar with it, they take objectifying and oftentimes ridiculous pictures of women in comics, and they replace him with Hawkeye. So here he's feeling empowered. There's a lot wrong with the image on the left, but the artist really wanted to emphasize butts, I think. If men fought like women in comics, and we talked about those genital thrusting mid-air kicks. The Hawkeye Initiative hasn't been around for that long, but it has even inspired a bit of cosplay.
Yes!
All right, so why did I bother with this? You know, what's the point of studying comics within an art historical context? Well, according to feminist art historian Linda Need, she argues that the high art female nude cannot be studied in isolation, but needs to be looked at in the broader context of its relationship with various forms of mass culture. I believe the reverse is also true. And if we're going to combat female objectification in comics, the first step is to understand when and how it's happening. And we can't adequately analyze the representations of women in comic books without first understanding the modes of representation that came first. Thank you.
Okay, reminder, we're holding questions till the end. We have another presenter, Kari Storla from the USC Annenberg School, is here to talk to us about Writing While White. I didn't need a representation of women and people of color in Princessless.
Princeless. I did that twice today.
Sorry.
Princeless is an all-ages comic authored by Jeremy Lin. It was written with the premise that you can talk to kids about important issues without being condescending. As a result, it offers a lot of important lessons about the value of friendship, staying true to yourself, and the dangers of the military-industrial complex. If you can't read that, she's talking to a dragon and she says, "No, listen, Sparky. The people who stand to profit off of training and domesticating dragons are the same ones who make the weapons that slay them." Princeless also addresses issues of race and gender. It's the story of Adrian, a woman of color, but it was written by a white man. This is something that's potentially problematic, but it doesn't have to be. It is possible to write characters who don't necessarily match you on gender or race. We're going to use Princeless as an example to talk about one approach, although it's certainly not the only one that this could be done. We're going to talk about Princeless and summarize it, talk about briefly some of the history of gender and race in comics, talk about some of the problems and possible solutions for writing minority characters when you're not, when you're in the majority, and then talk about some of the implications of this and what it means for the hero. Princess is the story of Princess Adrian. She is pretty much the definition of the self-rescuing princess. At the age of 16, her father sticks her in a tower where she's supposed to await being rescued by a prince. However, she decides that that's not what she's going to do, and instead befriends the dragon who's guarding her, and sets off and decides not only to rescue herself, but to rescue all of her sisters as well. This really shows a lot of agency on Adrian's part, and it's a very positive example. Adrian is also really conscious of issues of race and gender, and this is prevalent throughout the comic. At one point, she criticizes a prince who uses the word fair as a compliment to her, and at another point, she critiques pastiches of well-known armors, such as like the chain of
nice.
A lot of the issues of gender and race that Adrian herself brings up in the comic are ones that we've seen again and again throughout comic history. I'm going to assume you're familiar with a lot of these and not spend a lot of time. Can we just talk about some of them? The fact that women and people of color compromise a minority, both behind the scenes and on the page, isn't something that should surprise anyone at this point. This is also something that's mirrored in other industries. When people of color and women do appear in comics, they're often appear as stereotypes and are token characters. Part of this has to do, or the argument that people make for this, is that in comics you need to get a message across quickly. So that's why we use stereotypes, that's really how we have to get it across. We just need to talk about these characters. However, nobody makes that argument about white males in comics. We don't use stereotypes to talk about them. The reason for that is that white males are set as the default setting, essentially. So that argument about stereotypes doesn't really stand up. So these issues with stereotypes can be really problematic when somebody goes to write a character. As Dwayne McDuffie, one of the founders of Milestone Media, talked about, when you have a character who's black or Asian or gay, or anything that's not what's considered the norm, they become a representative of that group rather than being an individual. Superman's Superman. We attribute his actions and his characteristics to him as an individual. With Wonder Woman, we may attribute to them those things to her being a woman rather than to her as an individual. One of the problems with this is that there's not enough diversity in who's writing comics. There's some association between having more, for example, women as writers during World War II, and then there were more women heroines during World War II as well. There's also a study by the Gina Davis Institute on Gender and Media that found a correlation between the number of women who served as producers, writers, and directors. If there was at least one woman serving as one of those, there was a higher number of women who had speaking roles in film. But of course, increasing the number of creators is wonderful. And that's something that should happen. But it's not the only thing that we can do to better representation in comic books. Cheryl Lynn Eaton, who's the founder of the, I might mispronounce this and I apologize for that, the Ormus Society, which is a group dedicated to promoting the work of Black women comic creators, argues that anybody can write any character. They just need to have the motivation. However, it's slightly more complicated than that. The dominant group tends to dominate popular culture. They often appropriate and commodify that. We've seen examples of this recently with, say, twerking in the Harlem Shake. And this is problematic because the dominant group is taking something that's a part of the culture, claiming it for their own, even though it's not, and erasing the voices of the people who originally came up with it. This is something that needs to be addressed if, for example, a white male is going to write a woman of color. There's several ways to deal with this. And one thing that we need to talk about is terministic screens. Terministic screens were something that came up, that Kenneth Burke came up with. Kenneth Burke's picture has nothing to do with this. He's just my favorite theorist, so his picture goes up there. Terministic screens are something that affect how we see the world. Essentially, we've all had different experiences, and those affect how we see our points of view. Terministic screens select, deflect, and reflect reality. There was a study by Rockler that looked at perceptions of the comics Jump Street and the Boondocks by European Americans and African Americans. And this study found that European Americans tended to like Jump Street, while African Americans tended to like Boondocks. Each one was able to identify with one more. The reason, according to Rockler, was that Jump Street tended to deflect from issues of race. And it tended to have a deterministic screen of whiteness, that white norm that we talked about earlier, where white was considered the default. So these deterministic screens can really affect how we see the world. If you want to think about them, as Burke did, as a metaphor, talked about them as photo filters. If you want to update that slightly, you can think of them like Instagram filters. It's the same picture, but when you put a filter on it, when you put your deterministic screen over it, based on your experiences, it changes it, and it changes what kind of things you focus on. Essentially, we all have different vocabulary to come to this. With deterministic screens, it means that Whitley, the author of Princeless, as a white male, isn't someone who can speak with authority about females or people of color. He lacks ethos on this matter, which is his credibility, his character. It's the ways in which the perceived attributes of a speaker manifesting discourse are persuasive. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. I'm not arguing that he should be an authority on women or people of color. As we discussed earlier, there are reasons for this. What I am arguing is that if he's going to write women and people of color, he needs to take this into account, and he needs to acknowledge it and take steps to it. There are many ways that he can do this. One way he could do it is to become a legislator, because apparently, as we've learned in the news in the past years, becoming a legislator makes you an expert on women. Whitley thankfully chose a different route, which was that of dialogue. This is an idea from Schotter, and it really owes a debt to the work of Bakhtin, but he came up with the idea of the dialogical, perspective, relational approach to writing when talking about academic writing, which contrasts with the monological, retrospective, objective approach to writing. I'm not going to be saying this entire time. I'm just going to say dialogical. But they do have much longer names. The dialogical approach is essentially talking with people. When you're talking with people from other groups, you're not just standing there on the outside saying, this is how things are for you. I know this. This is how the objective reality is. Instead, you're talking with them, you're looking at how different things relate to one another, and it's a more respectful approach. This is what's used in principles. This is a quote from Whitley, and it shows how one of the ways in which he uses the dialogical approach. He acknowledges that there are differences in his experience that affect how he's going to write this comic book versus how somebody else would. In other words, he's seeing a different terministic screen. One of the key parts here is that as I'm thinking about it, there are things I think about that I wouldn't necessarily key in on as being a problem. But if I run it by my wife, Alicia, she can say, oh, well, that might not be the way to say it. Whitley's wife is a person of color, or a woman of color. So he runs it by her. Now, to some people, this may smack of the, I'm not a racist because I have a black friend excuse. Which is a valid criticism at this point. However, to me, and this is debatable, it seems to me that while this is not necessarily without criticism, it is different from that because it's not just saying, well, this isn't at all problematic because I'm associating myself with this, but because there's active engagement. And you're, instead of just saying, well, I know somebody who's black, you're talking to people who have had those experiences, taking what they're telling you into account and adapting your own work so that their voices can be can be heard. In addition to this, Whitley has made sure to explicitly acknowledge that he is a white male writing this comic. He also has taken pains to promote the work of, for example, black female creators. Along with his own. This is some of the ways that he's engaging in this dialogic approach. It can be seen within the comic itself. One of the ways this happens is with multiple characters. We talked about how when you only have, for example, one woman in a comic book, she comes to stand for all women. That doesn't happen in Princeless. Or it happens a lot less. I don't want to say that Princeless is perfect because nothing is. There are a wide cast of characters. There's women, there's plenty of people, I don't want to say plenty, but there are numerous people of color. There are a variety of spectrum characters. In addition to Adrian, she has numerous sisters. There's Bedelia, who's a biracial blacksmith, and others. This lessens the reliance on stereotypes. These characters are not reduced to a single aspect of their identity, but instead are allowed to be individuals. One of the ways this is seen is in the example of Adrian and Angelica, who's one of her sisters. Angelica and Adrian are completely different characters. They're not the same. They're not just like, this is what a black woman is, and all the black women in this comic are going to be exactly the same. They're completely different. It's also part of the example is that although they have different points of view, Angelica, for example, doesn't want to be rescued. She thinks she's fine the way she is. She likes being beautiful and likes people trying to princess fight for her. However, in the comic, both points of view, both terministic screens, are recognized as being ones that the characters have. Both characters are able to engage in a dialogue and learn from each other. This idea, the idea of respecting multiple points of view, of engaging in dialogue, and of talking, about it, of the multiple terministic screen, is what's essential to someone from the majority writing on the minority. Of course, I don't want to ignore the fact that I'm white and I'm talking about this. That would be completely wrong. Because, again, I don't have the authority. This is what I've gained from what I've read, what I've researched, some of the people I've talked to. But other people are coming from different terministic screens, and their opinions are more valid on this topic from their experiences than mine. The majority people who come from a majority group, such as white males, writing people who come from a minority group, such as women of color, has the potential to be incredibly problematic. You can have stereotypes and all sorts of things. However, it has the potential to increase representation as well. The keys are to acknowledge that everyone is coming from a different place, and to engage in this respectful dialogue, and to not only engage in the dialogue, but to apply the lessons rather than just saying, well, I listened to you, but I'm just going to go ahead and do what I think anyway. This has applications beyond simply comics. Other identities, other media, in academia, like Schotter's original essay, and even in interpersonal interactions as well. It's important as well not to overstate the impact that Whitley has had. He's one person who's working on this, and he is not some like crusader at the head of a movement. I think that he's done good work here, but at the end of the day, what he's done is just one small piece of a much larger puzzle for representation for women and people of color in comics. And it may ultimately not be the largest or most important piece. There are a lot of other steps as well that need to be taken, including increasing representation behind the scenes. Just as Adrienne's journey to rescue her sisters continues, so too does the mission for better representation for all sorts of groups in comics.
Okay, thank you. All right, we have time for questions. Jonathan?
This is for both of my colleagues up there. Quick question. First, to what degree does the author of Princeless's whiteness allow him to actually do this? That is, his own white privilege allows him to move through a space dominated by whiteness and tell these kinds of stories versus a person of color whose very materiality stops them from moving through this space. And the second question is for my other colleague. To what degree is this distortion of the female body an intrinsic part of comics as a media organized around the male gaze, around whiteness, around masculine interests in the female body, and therefore representative of those things?
Sure. I talked about that in my full paper. I didn't have time to include everything here, but you're absolutely right that Whitley has had advantages in the comics industry and in life because of the fact that he is a white male, and he's acknowledged that as well. It's not just that there's these individual pieces and they don't affect each other. It's a systemic issue. So the fact that Whitley was able to publish this, even if it had, let's just say that there was the exact same comic, it wouldn't have been the exact same comic, but let's pretend it would have been, was published by a black male or a black female or anybody else, it would not have been as easy for it to have been published. It's a reality. So yes, that's entirely accurate. And acknowledging that as well is important, I think, anyway.
And to answer your question, I'm going to play off of something that you were talking about in your presentation with white heterosexual male being the default. So basically, the male gaze is the idea that these images are being made for men to look at, because despite the fact that women make up more than half the population, I'm still the default for some reason. So I think that is very, very accurate. The idea that there's still, I think it was Dan Ditko that recently talked about the Tumblr as like code for women fans, because you know there's just like the Tumblr people, like we don't even want to say the word woman because that's like dirty. So I think very much. I don't even think that all these artists. Let me put it this way: I don't think any of these artists meant to do something hateful. that doesn't mean, that doesn't excuse them, certainly. I think that they grew up seeing women going like this, so that's what they drew. Like I pointed out on that one slide, the compositions and the poses start mirroring each other, even if they're doing two different actions, because that is the way that it has been, and that's the way it, you know, should be. And I don't think that a lot of people think about it, because it's a bunch of white guys making comics. So of course everybody's just like us.
This is for both of you together, and this is an issue because I'm a huge comic nerd for a long time as a woman. That there are a lot of women I know, and there's a lot of women in this room who say they want more comics drawn for them, but they don't buy comics. Now, what about the argument that's been presented? Because I run a Facebook page posting my comics, it's Boxy Mail, and they say they want more representation, but they won't put their money where their mouth is. So the argument that you've heard, I'm sure, from comic book companies is, we're just putting out what sells because we have to make money. So where do you think that fits in the promotion of trying to get a better representation of women and about promoting women creators if we've got to get women to buy comics as well to support that or change that argument? How would we change that argument from comic book creators?
I think what you're saying is absolutely true. They like to say, well, look, this stuff doesn't sell, so we're not going to make it. There's a letter going around the internet from a movie company where somebody submitted a script, a fantasy script with a female protagonist, and I can't remember the name of it, some like a screenwriter, and they got a letter back and they published the letter, and the letter said that movies with women leads don't sell because Sucker Punch did that.
Logical.
And I think that comic book companies have that same idea because the default is white guy. So it's, you know, if a movie starring a male lead flops, they're not going to say, oh, well, I guess people don't want movies with guys in them. It's women are treated as a niche market. And it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you have a comic book store and you put up pictures like I was showing, well, you're going to alienate a certain demographic, and then you're going to have people coming in asking for stuff with women in 90-degree spines, and then you're going to be like, oh, wow, Lady Death sells. I better put up some more Lady Death posters. And then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's very cyclical. So I think that that's what comic book publishers do. They also don't know how to, because they're a bunch of white guys, write for people of color, for women, for anyone that isn't a straight white guy. They, like I showed you that Women of Marvel cover. They had a miniseries featuring some of their less known female characters. Well, how about we remove them, we'll strip away their normal costume, and we'll put them in like burlesque versions. And then, oh, why isn't the women book selling? Well, was that your honest to God attempt to cater to women? There's a Superman Wonder Woman panel recently, and the creators were talking about it, and they said, oh, don't worry, you know, this book will be popular with women fans because of Twilight, and we'll put in a lot of shots of Superman's butt.
Thanks.
So yeah, there you go. That's what DC thinks that you want.
Just to add to that quickly, the argument that you made is grossly simplifying that issue. There's also things to do with advertising as well. They don't advertise comics in areas where women are going to see them. There is also, if you want to relate it to video games, which in many ways has similarities, there was a study where they had the Game Boy Advance, and they gave it to a bunch of women and had them play it. And a lot of them were like, this is great, I want one. Then they showed them the advertisements. The tagline was for men. The comments then were like, well, why can't I have one? This isn't for me, I don't want one anymore. So there's a lot involved with that.
I have a rather complicated question. I want to first say I'm a bisexual woman who's currently dating a pansexual male. One thing I noticed when we were showing the images of men who were reversed now showing the female poses is that a lot of people laughed. And one thing that I find depressing about that is that this pose, which is supposed to represent sexuality, is being viewed as hilarious when a man does it. Going back to the pansexual male I'm dating, he actually views when men do that pose as something sexual. We both kind of have this definitely preconceived notion of sexuality and when we represent ourselves as presentable. Why do you think that when a male shows himself in such a pose, we automatically view it as comedic rather than something as, here's a male who can also display his sexuality? Why is sexuality subjective rather than something that can be expressed freely with both male and female sexes?
Because society sucks. You know, with things like the Hawkeye Initiative, I think part of it is the fact that when we see a man with a 90-degree back, that's funny because we don't see it. I'm sure some people, I'm not talking about necessarily anyone in the room, but I'm sure some people are laughing for the wrong reasons. But I do think that outlining the difference in the depictions of men and women are accurate. You know, I don't think that it's necessarily, you know, transphobic or LGBTQ phobic to laugh at a picture of, you know, a man with like a 90-degree spinal column, because we should be laughing at that. But the thing is that we should be laughing at the female version too. But we've been so inundated with these images that we don't see it. Even me, when I'm reading comics, sometimes I'll just, you know, reading it, and I'm reading it for the story, and then I'll like close it and I'll look at the cover and be like, oh my god, why I didn't even see that? And it just goes right over my head. So I think that with some of that fan art, it has to kind of, putting a man in the pose does make you stop. But at the same time, I do think a few of the chuckles aren't necessarily for the right reason, and that's equally problematic.
Question. Over the last 10 years, the census reports have shown a 34% increase in the number of multiracials. The country is essentially getting browner. Has that had an effect on the comic industry, or do you forecast that it will?
I can't show you exact statistics on the numbers of people in comics. I can tell you that there was a study about the character Aranya. They did a review of that. And they thought it was going to be great because there's this new character, it's going to be so great. And they found that instead, a lot of the depictions of her, even though she was there and she was the main character, were still very stereotyped. I think that we are moving towards that. I think we should be moving towards that. But I don't want to predict anything. I can't predict anything. I think that as we move forward, though, it's a direction that we're probably
I'd like to speak to that. I think a big part depends on what comics you're talking about. You know, almost every image in my presentation is about Marvel and DC, and that's what a lot of people talk about. Last year here, I actually did do a quantitative 6-month study of the Avengers, X-Men, and Justice League, and I compared race and gender to the census data. It's not even close as far as representation. I mean, I would like to say yes, but I don't think that I can. I mean, two years ago, DC rebooted their continuity, and the new Justice League was the old Justice League with a black guy at it. One woman and, like, what, 7 guys? So, I mean, we could have done whatever we wanted to do, or they could have done whatever they wanted to do. Steel could have been on that team. They got rid of people of color. They got rid of women. Stephanie Brown is nowhere. DC in the past 2 years has made their comics more white and literally erased women and people of color from their comics.
This kind of bounces off one of the slides that you showed. Picture of Olympia. You used it as a image of the woman as a sexual subject, but it's also interesting for its use of women of color as props in that.
That's interesting. I've done a fair amount of research on that image, and I've looked for things about that woman of color, and there's not a whole lot written. It was a contemporary setting, that could account for it. It was just supposed to look like normal every day. Also the use of color that he does, he uses washed out color, so she's very, very, very pale. There's not a lot of shading, so it could just be to kind of balance that out to make, you know, that background figure not pop because the subject is the white woman. But some people hated the black woman in the photo at the time that it came out, or the painting, sorry, as much as they hated Olympia, and talked about her being the woman. She was called, one art historian, and I'm paraphrasing, I believe they actually said the grotesque negress in the background was distracting. And so people were actually upset about her very inclusion, the fact that a black woman exists. And people got upset about that. One interpretation, and I can't speak with absolute authority on this, is that he's painting a prostitute here, which is like an undesirable, and he chose that as a subject for a painting, and that he did the same thing with another undesirable by putting her in there, so that it's showcasing people that are generally overlooked. It's a very positive reading of it, but again, I can't speak with total authority. I would like to hope that that's what he was going for, but again, I haven't found enough about from Manet's writings. Manet's only read about his work once, and it was just like a little, hey, I'm doing this show here. He didn't speak about his work. He let the work speak for itself, so it's really hard to say definitively, but that is an excellent one.
I'm curious to know what your argument would be against comic creators who say that comics aren't created for women or for people of color, or, you know, that's not their realm, so that's why we're allowed to do this.
Screw you. Only I'd probably use more colorful language. Comics are a medium. They're not for anybody unless they're for everybody. The idea that comics are just for men is ridiculous. Historically, if you go back far enough, there were just as many girls reading comics as young boys. This is one of those things that I just find so ridiculous that it makes me angry. Because there's so much of what backs up that argument, if you try to look at it, it has nothing to do with girls and women not liking comics. It has to do with the fact that they're not exposed to them, they're told they're not supposed to like them, they're not given comics, they are essentially, they don't have roles in comics. I don't read comics as much as I used to anymore, because I'm sick of reading terrible representations and just things that make me want to throw them against the wall. So there's so many different factors involved, that it's not comics aren't for women, it's that there are systemic factors involved that make women not seek out, not know about, or not think that they would like comics. I'm sure there are women that don't like comics, and they honestly don't, comics aren't for them. But as a whole, that's whole.
I know there are more questions, but we're out of time. We're actually over time a little bit. So let me just make an announcement before we thank our speakers. One of the academic panels that's happening on Monday in our little program is, there's an error in the schedule. It's at 2:30, the one on multimodal literacy and comics. But I think it's going to be a really cool panel, so don't miss it, because we mislabeled it. It's right in the DragonCon program, though, so you should be able to find it. Please join me in thanking our speakers.